so that the various national systems in the EU are joined up, so that if you register in one country, that will work in another one. What I hear is each member state is developing its own app to try and ease the process of applying for this new visa that we'll need to apply for, but the predictably, perhaps, work is a little bit behind schedule on those.
Right. Well, it all sounds very complicated, even if we're looking forward to some better weather and summer holidays. Anna Menon, Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London and Director of the UK in a Changing Europe. Thank you very much for talking to us. Well, thanks for your company this afternoon. It's all we have time for at The Times at One. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. Jane and Fee are here next. I wonder what's happened in that meeting with Keir Starmer and the women MPs in the Parliamentary Labour Party.
Do you think they gave him what for?
I think they probably did. Well, they said, the ones I'd spoken to, that they were going to. Fancy going from Prime Minister's questions and then into that.
What is the expression?
Well, it's definitely not exfoliation followed by moisturisation, is it? It's exfoliation followed by more exfoliation.
I was going to say, with even bigger granules, if that's the right expression. Anyway, have a good programme.
Well, we'll do our best, but we're only women, so look, who knows?
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And Joe is back tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Good afternoon. It's 2 now. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It will be busy this afternoon. In the next 2 hours, after a rollercoaster of a week for Keir Starmer, Kemi Badenoch has been pressing him at PMQs. We will discuss that with his former political director, Luke Sullivan. The British Museum will be celebrating Valentine's Day by securing a heart pendant from the country's most famous divorce. We'll be joined by the museum's curator. From swanky aircon to touchscreen coffee machine, are our smart offices leaving the door wide open to cyber criminals? And after 3:30, from the cabinet table to the carving studio, Zach Goldsmith on swapping frontline politics for life as an animal sculptor.
Intriguing. Let's get the news at 2. Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thank you. The Prime Minister has accused his former communications chief of lying to him about his connections to a paedophile when he was elevated to the House of Lords. Lord Doyle supported Sean Morton for a council election after Morton was convicted of possessing indecent images of children. Sir Keir Starmer says Lord Doyle wasn't clear with him during the appointments process and he insists that he has improved vetting.
I'll tell you what other action we've taken, Mr. Speaker. Along with the safeguarding minister, I and this government have introduced the most far-reaching vile against women and girls trafficking. And I'll tell you what else we've done. This government has introduced a pay rise for millions of working class women.
Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch accused the Prime Minister of putting paedophile apologists in his team after making Lord Mandelson ambassador to Washington, while the Liberal Democrat leader Sir Ed Davey also criticised Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, to appoint one paedophile supporter cannot be excused as misfortune. To appoint two shows a catastrophic lack of judgment.
The Prime Minister has attended a meeting of the Women's Parliamentary Labour Party since PMQs to try to shore up his support. Volodymyr Zelensky is said to be planning to announce a spring election alongside a referendum on any peace deal. The Financial Times reports the Ukrainian leader intends to announce that on the 24th of February, the fourth anniversary of Russia's invasion. Alexei Sorokin, deputy chief editor for the Kyiv Independent, told Times Radio the referendum idea is most likely.
The Ukrainian parliament is currently unstable. The government majority is on the brink of collapse, and also a lot of lawmakers are not attending sessions. So what they envision is if there's any kind of peace deal, they want the support of the Ukrainian people. So in 90 days following a peace agreement, they would want a referendum in Ukraine.
A Polish butcher who cut her girlfriend in half and buried her in a garden has been sentenced to at least 21 years in prison. 30-year-old Izabela Zabloka lost contact with her family in August 2010. 40-year-old Anna Podorwana was found guilty of killing her at their home in Derby. At least 10 people are dead and 27 injured after a school shooting in Western Canada. 8 people were killed at the school, with 2 more found dead at a home believed to be connected to the incident in British Columbia. The shooter has been described as female, but police have not confirmed their gender. 16 migrants are attempting to block their deportations in the High Court. The lawsuit is challenging new legal guidance introduced by the government to prevent migrants using Britain's modern slavery laws to delay their deportation. And the Premier League side Tottenham Hotspur have sacked Thomas Frank as manager. They are only 5 points clear of the relegation zone after winning just two of their last 17 games. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, how are you? Hope you're fit and well this rather dreary... Oh no, it's just... What's happening outside?
Blue sky, Jane, has emerged. Gosh. Do you recognise it? Hello, stranger.
Wow, incredible. OK, it has briefly stopped raining here in London town. Hope it's reasonable where you are, but if you are looking at sodden fields and a sopping wet high street, we're very sorry. It doesn't look as though it's going to get any better anytime soon. So between now and 4 o'clock this afternoon here on Times Radio, well, we'll look back at another stormy PMQs. This week, the SNP Stephen Flynn accused Keir Starmer of being the most gullible former director of public prosecutions in history. Kemi Badenoch of the Tories said the government was stuffed with paedophile apologists. We're going to hear in a moment from the PM's former political director. Beware, your sleek, smart office is coming under attack and something very bad could happen to you. Make sure you're listening to that a little later. There's news of a triumph for the British Museum. Millions have been raised to keep a 24-carat gold pendant once owned by Catherine of Aragon. TV news with Scott Bryan. We'll ask whether television drama has really hit rock bottom with an ITV thriller featuring a hemorrhoid treatment. And last night, the Spurs boss, Thomas Frank, said he was convinced he'd keep his job. You wouldn't want him as Mystic Frank. This morning he was fired. We'll have more on that in our sports news with Vassos Alexander. And still no glory for Team GB on the slopes or on the luge or on the rink or wherever. But
no, but it's still very entertaining. Yeah.
And our big guest after 3:30 is...
Zach Goldsmith. So he found in lockdown that he needed something to do and he lent into an artistic nature that he didn't really know that he had. He started doing some sculptures, initially of a jackdaw who used to come and eat worms out of his hand as he was striding around the New Forest. That turned into some bronze sculptures, and it's turned into a whole collection, which he's been auctioning for charity, £500,000 worth of bronze so far. Art for Nature is his project. You can go online and have a look at all of the things that he's made, and he is in after 3:30. We will try and convert that into good radio. Sometimes doing sculpture on the radio is a little bit tricky. Well, we've got lots of other things to talk about.
If anyone can, it's you. You'll bring it to life.
That is such a terrible, terrible call to action. So I've got an hour and a half to get ready for that, but do stay with us until four.
Right. Thank you very much. What are the most read stories on the Times website right now?
Well, in at number three is this extraordinary story that has slightly eclipsed some of the sport coming from Milana Curtino. Cheating Olympian girlfriend says it's hard to forgive after confession. A Norwegian biathlete stunned viewers by confessing to being unfaithful to his ex-partner. She's told Norway's press that she's not particularly impressed. The second most read story, Mick Jagger's fiancé shaken after being attacked at Annabelle. Melanie Hamrick said two people grabbed her from behind before another person stepped in to protect her. This happened at the private members club in Mayfair. And the most read piece on the Times website, Politics Live, Badenoch accuses Starmer of appointing paedophile apologists. The Conservative leader attacked the PM over his former Downing Street communications director, Lord Doyle. More on that in just a moment's time. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Okay, now you know that we love to hear from you. The WhatsApp number is 0333 003 2353. Let's get stuck in. We're here till 4 o'clock, whether you like it or not. Let's go back to PMQs. And actually, our guest today is Luke Sullivan, who is Keir Starmer's political director until 2024. Hello, Luke.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Why did you leave?
For a variety of reasons. I think I was ready for a change. I'd done 16 long years, and I sort of got slightly a victim of the chaos, I think, that is well publicised.
What, Labour Party chaos?
The Labour Party chaos, which I'm sure your listeners would never imagine could possibly be the case.
They're quite interested in it. We'll have more on that in a moment. So you never actually served with him in government?
Not with Keir Starmer, no. Oh. I was a very, very junior special advisor in the dying days of the last Labour government under Gordon Brown from 2008. But no, not this Labour government, sadly.
All right, well, let's go back then to what happened in PMQs today. It was difficult, inevitably, and the Prime Minister faced a tough time after revelations that he'd ennobled an aide who had supported an accused paedophile. Now, this comes after the row over Mandelson's appointment as ambassador to the US, despite him being an associate of Jeffrey Epstein. Here is the Tory leader, Kemi Badenoch, accusing the PM of putting paedophile sympathisers into positions of power.
How dare he criticise us? We weren't the ones stuffing government with hypocrites and paedophile apologists. He can't build a team, Mr. Speaker. He has no plan. He can't even run his own office, let alone the country. He is now dealing with a new scandal of appointing someone who campaigned for a man convicted of having indecent pictures of girls as young as 10. Isn't the Prime Minister ashamed that that will be his legacy?
Kemi Badenoch in her pomp at PMQs today. Luke, is it possible for someone like you actually to be completely objective, to watch PMQs and not to see it through the prism of your former role at the heart of the Labour Party?
Probably not, no.
So tell us how you saw this edition then.
Probably not, no. I try to be, but I also often recognise that people were watching it with their viewpoints, so I often watch it as a political obsessive, somebody thinking, where could this be going? And I thought it was one of those interesting ones where both the Prime Minister and Kemi Badenoch were trying to address different audiences, and often the drama of Prime Minister's questions. I mean, I think today had as big a billing as you would expect. I mean, I think this is an objective view. I thought Kemi Badenoch had some very, very strong lines. And I think the clip you played there, I think if you watch the news tonight, will be very, very strong. And
yeah,
and look, 99% of the people who will have seen Prime Minister's questions will only see a 10-second clip or hear that. So from that point of view, I thought it was very effective in terms of the sound bites. I thought in terms of the political peril of the Prime Minister, I didn't feel it pushed that on. And bizarrely, I think the Prime Minister, as difficult as this week has been, and if you take the arc of last Wednesday, I thought the moment that crystallised the political problem for the Prime Minister was a very forensic set of questions from Kemi Badenoch. And it was that moment when I think you could almost see Labour MPs sort of understand what the logic and answer of the government's position had been over Peter Mandelson. It sort of taken that moment for her to ask the question and hear the Prime Minister's
They should have asked the question.
Answers. Well, look, there's potentially, but, you know, and not to make excuses for MPs. Look, they're very busy. They are getting on with their jobs. They are interested in politics and following it, but often aren't a focus on other things. I thought the mistake from Kemi Badenoch this week, and maybe from her point of view, she'll be very happy because the clips are strong, but it didn't seem it pushed on the story. I thought if I had been in her position purely from how do I damage and put the Prime Minister into further political problems, I think I would have gone with very detailed forensic questions along the line she did last week. And I think that would have been difficult for the Prime Minister. I think he was probably quite happy with where she went.
All right. Well, I mean, she did have potentially more ammunition about Matthew Doyle, the former Labour comms director, who had campaigned for a man called Sean Morton after Morton had been charged with indecent images of children offences. Now, we should say at the time that Matthew Doyle was campaigning for him, he hadn't admitted the offences, but he did go on to do so. So this is how this was raised by Kemi Badenoch.
The Mandelson episode was not an isolated incident. A few weeks ago, he announced a peerage for one Matthew Doyle, his former director of communications. Immediately after that, the Sunday Times published on the front page that Doyle campaigned for a man charged with child sex offences. Yet despite the Prime Minister knowing this, he gave Doyle a job for life in the House of Lords anyway. Why?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, Matthew Dole did not give a full account of his actions. And on Monday, I promised my party and my country there would be change. And yesterday, I removed the whip from Matthew Doyle. I'll tell you what other action we've taken, Mr. Speaker. Along with the safeguarding minister, I and this government have introduced the most far-reaching Violence against Women and Girls strategy.
That was the Prime Minister obviously attempting to respond there. But we are back to the accusation put by the SNP that Keir Starmer is, I've got the quote here, the most gullible former director of public prosecutions in history. He is lied to, and he can't see through those lies. It just seems to keep happening.
I mean, I thought it was interesting that Stephen Flynn's question, I think he only had one, and Ed Davies' first question were probably more difficult for the Prime Minister in many ways than some of the questions from Kemi Badenoch. But yes, this goes to the heart of, I think, why I would have asked much more forensic questions. I think when you get the opportunity of having six questions, you can expose, like Kemi Badenoch did last week, the uncomfortable answers that a Prime Minister will end up having to give, knowing that they're ultimately truthful and honest people who don't lie in Parliament. Now, I think when you put it like that, it's a strong political charge. I think what the Prime Minister did get through today was, he was forced to put on the record an allegation against Lord Doyle in terms of the answers he gave and the accounts he gave through the process. But this is going to roll on, I'm sure, for days to come.
Yeah.
Now, from the Prime Minister's point of view, Parliament goes into recess tomorrow. Most MPs,
I
suspect.
It cannot come too soon.
It cannot come, but the point of danger, in my opinion, was 2 o'clock, was 2 o'clock today. I think they will feel a huge sigh of relief to have got to here. And I think on points on Monday, and speaking to some people in Number 10, on points on Monday, that was far from certain.
Okay, so Monday, honestly, they could have been preparing to get the delivery vans round there.
I don't think. I mean, I've seen some people out attacking
vans,
the media. Not removal vans. I've seen some people out attacking the media for saying this is media concoction. Sadly, that's not the case. And I think, as Ed Miliband said on Tuesday, it was Tuesday. It's been a very long week this week. But as Ed Miliband said on Tuesday, the Parliamentary Labour Party, he said, looks over the precipice and step back. And look, that's a very close ally of the Prime Minister saying that. He's wants the Prime Minister to succeed. And frankly, he's been there when he's had his own leadership challenges. So, I think that was a more honest assessment.
OK, so we'll look back on Monday with some fondness. We thought it was all going to happen on our show, didn't we? And according to Luke, it nearly did, but didn't.
It didn't. No, we rode back as well.
Yeah, we did, because we pulled out the febrile adjective.
Oh, I think it was febrile. Was it? Absolutely was.
Thank God. Right, OK. Now, Kemi Badenoch can be pretty pithy, but I'd like you to listen to this. This is Times Radio's very own Aisha Hazarika, putting it, I would say, exceptionally pithily. Here she is.
Forget the vetting process. What's just happening? I mean, I don't want to be rude, but the nonce detector at Downing Street, I don't mean light of it, but what is going on?
Well, I mean, she does raise a good point there. Now, Fi and I were talking about this earlier, Luke. We wonder whether women in general, perhaps particularly middle-aged women, have just had to have quite finely tuned antennae. We rate our ability, don't we? I'm looking at Fi now, to sniff out a wrong'un, because we've had decades of having to do precisely that.
Well, we do, and we don't always manage to do it. So there is fallibility in the way that the world looks at other people in the world, because, you know, paedophiles are there in plain sight. They don't look different. They don't smell different. But in a serious vetting of a candidate who's going to represent other people in public office, there are ways that you can go beyond that Jane and I don't have in the street, you wouldn't have as a, you know, parent or person in the street. And that's the huge problem, isn't it? People don't seem to realise that you just need to be checking everybody.
Look, I think there's a fair point. And I think part of why this is cut through, look, first things first, if I'm allowed to say it on Times Radio, the public, I think there's no group of people they hate more than nonces. That's just a given.
I think that's an entirely reasonable thing,
which is completely understandable. And I think when you reflect on where we are politically, and this is a political crisis, not just for the Prime Minister, but I actually think for Westminster as a whole, it goes to the heart of how power and, you know, especially male power works. And I think one of the things that the public just don't understand, and I think the vetting point's really, really an interesting one, is that people in all walks of life, if they're going for a relatively junior job anywhere, have to do a CRB check, have to, you know, their social media is searched and other things like that. And that is just fundamentally, I think, the political problem that the government find themselves in, which goes to the heart of why Kemi's question last week was so devastating, because it is you knew and you still appointed XYZ. Yeah.
Very briefly, did you work with Matthew Doyle?
I did. I worked with Matthew from the end. Well, we were both relatively appointed at the same time, which is post Hartlepool by-election from about June 2021 to July 24.
And would you acknowledge that perhaps you were both part of a so-called boys club around the then leader of the opposition?
I recognise that allegation in the sense that it was something that was, I think it was, you know, charged, alleged at a group of people in and around Keir Starmer. I would hope that people never thought that I was part of what that was, but I do recognise that that was, you know, often in life it's the vibe, it's the feeling you give off, and that was a very damaging allegation. And I think, whilst I don't think it was right and entirely fair, I understand why some people felt like that.
Okay, let's have a listen to, there were other people at PMQs today. Ed Davey, leader of the Lib Dems. Here's his first question. It's quite devastating in its own way. Here we are.
Mr. Speaker, to appoint one paedophile supporter cannot be excused as misfortune. To appoint two shows a catastrophic lack of judgment. The Right Honourable Gentleman once told this House that when a Prime Minister refuses to take responsibility, and I quote, it only serves to convince people that things cannot get better, that governments cannot improve people's lives, and that progress is not possible because politics does not work. Does he still agree with himself? And does he share my fear that is exactly what is happening now?
Well, that's Ed Davey. And here's the Prime Minister angrily, I think it's fair to say, responding.
People in this country, millions of people, have been let down for years and years and years. And one of the reasons was austerity, which his party supported. He should take accountability and take responsibility for what he has inflicted on this country.
Surrender,
Mr. Speaker, I think I touched a raw nerve.
Well, it does sound as though he did. Keir Starmer really did. Well, he sounded like a man on the brink a bit there. What do you say to that? Have you heard him like that before?
I think as I'd said earlier, I thought in a way Ed Davey and Stephen Flynn's questions were more effective because it was specifically in that space. Now, there's a limit on how many questions you've got, but I think that is at the heart of this political crisis for the Prime Minister, because at some point he's going to face, you know, two interviewers such as yourselves, and you're not unreasonably going to go down that line. And look, in the cauldron of the House of Commons, it's, you know, fine to get through going to a place of political attack. That is not going to work in a sit-down interview when he's, you know, in a long-form interview. And at some point he's going to do that, and he's going to have in the same way when we've seen him asked by journalists, a much more contrition and apology, and he's going to have to take on those questions. Now, it seems that he did take on those questions at a private meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party. It's understandable why that was an audience he was focused on. It's understandable in the format of PMQs that was where he resorted to. But you asked me at the beginning, can you be objective? I was trying to think as a sort of I'm a regular voter, human being, not that interested in politics. I think there was a danger for anybody tuning in to Prime Minister's questions today. It was a sort of plague on all political houses. And as I've thought for so much of the last 10 days, the only political party I think who are benefiting from this is Reform. It's all the perfect conditions for a right-wing populist government are being created. And I think that is how high the stakes are. And I think it's as simple as that. It's about how do the public see what's gone on and the accountability. Now, I hope the Prime Minister can get through this. But I think part of it is, and he did do this on Monday, we saw him do this yesterday, he's going to have some really good contrite answers to explain. And, you know, I've been saying for the last 10 days or so, I think he's going to get to a place where he just accepts he monumentally got it wrong, that he's looked at the evidence again, and even, yes, Peter Manderson lied, but he's looked at it and he recognises he made a catastrophic error.
OK, really briefly, in just one answer, is he going to survive?
Look, I hope so, and he's definitely going to...
That doesn't sound like a yes.
Well, look, I genuinely hope so, and he is going to survive. He's definitely going to survive until, and I say that, touch wood, he's definitely going to survive until February, I suspect.
February?
February. The end of the Denton and Gorton by-election.
I'll give him about 2 weeks.
But look, that is where he was at the start of the week. That would have been a good thing. He is fighting for his political life. I think, you know, it's going to be a huge test in May. But at the moment, he's got a lot of, as dire his political position is, he's fighting, he's making an argument about what he's doing. He's showing that, you know, the personality I've seen, which is he is at his best. And I know we all reach for sort of the trite things to say. He's much better in a scrap when his back's been against the wall. And he genuinely, and I know this is not just like the lines that get briefed out to journalists. He thinks he can turn it round. He thinks he's been in tight spots before, but you know, this is a very tight spot.
Luke, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. Former political director to Keir Starmer before he got elected as PM.
We would love your thoughts on everything we're talking about this afternoon. We're 0333 003 2353. A change of direction in the next couple of minutes. A symbol of love from the country's most notable divorce is coming to the British Museum. It's 25 minutes past two. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk. or visit your local Wix store.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wix.co.uk.
27 minutes past two, Henry VIII is more associated with beheadings and breakups than loving gifts. But one of his offerings has been saved for the nation just in time for Valentine's Day. It's a solid gold heart-shaped pendant given to Catherine of Aragon. The British Museum has secured its future at a cost of £3.5 million. Rachel King is the curator of Renaissance Europe at the British Museum, and she's been working on the pendant for years. Rachel, a very good afternoon from us. Paint us a picture. What does this Tudor heart look like?
Good afternoon. Well, I hope you've been able to see it in the galleries, but if not, it's a collar length necklace, a bit like a choker, suspended from which an enormous golden heart. It weighs in total about the same as a can of fizzy drink, and the heart pendant itself the same as an egg. Right. It's absolutely stupendous.
It's quite a heavy heart then.
It certainly is a heavy heart, but we're quite lighthearted today because we've had this super good news about having reached our fundraising target.
So tell us about the money. I mean, what would have happened to the pendant if the money hadn't been raised?
So according to Treasure legislation, which was brought in 1996, if a museum or interested body can't raise the reward, which is to be given to the finder, the object's returned to the finder, and the finder can then do that which they please. They could have it for their dog to wear as a collar if they wanted, or more often than not, it goes for sale, perhaps at auction.
Who was the finder?
So it was found in 2019 on December, Friday the 13th, by Mr. Charlie Clark, metal detecting near to Birmingham.
Gosh, what a day that would have been for him. Did he know immediately what kind of importance was attached to the find?
He says he didn't initially recognise it as being Tudor itself. He knew he'd found something very big and very, very blingy. But it was a couple of days later that he took it into the local finds liaison officer, and she says that she began shaking the moment she saw it, that she immediately recognised the motifs that link it to Henry VIII and his first wife, Catherine of Aragon.
Why was it there?
Oh, well, that's a question I hope that we might have an answer to now that it's been acquired for the nation. We've been trying to answer some of the questions around its age, when it was made for, what type of person could have worn it. But there are some questions still outstanding, and that's one of them.
Okay, so I mean, it could have been in somebody's possession far more recently than, you know, the initial wearer of it. It's unlikely to have been in that position for, you know, 400 years.
Well, yes or no, we don't know the answer to that, but we do have a lot of scientific techniques that we can apply in the museum, and we can say that it was in the ground for a substantial amount of time because of the type of degradation that had happened to the surface. But you're right, did it go in Henry VIII's time? Did it go in Charles II's time? Did it go in Queen Victoria's time? At the moment, we don't have an answer for that.
It does remind us of something that I think history often makes us forget with regard to Henry VIII, that actually his marriage to Catherine of Aragon was far longer than his other marriages, wasn't it? And, I mean, I've always liked to hope that there might have been some love involved in that one.
Well, yes, they were married for 24 years. So if you add up all of the other marriages, they don't reach that sum. And Henry's father said explicitly to him as a young man, don't marry her. She's the widow of your brother. But as soon as his father had died, yep, he was straight on with his proposal and the pair were married quite rapidly. There does seem to have been a lot of affection for one another. And even towards the end of the marriage, there are still very loving letters being written by Catherine, at least.
Okay, right. Well, I mean, I just hope that she had some happiness, because let's face it, I don't think an awful lot of his other wives did. Thank you very much indeed for telling us a little bit about that. If people do want to just have a gander at this extraordinary love gift, can they see it online as well as in the flesh?
Yeah. We've got wonderful pictures online, really high resolution 4K images, and it'll be more than a gander, it'll be a gape. It's such an astonishing thing.
Lovely. That's Rachel King, who is curator of Renaissance Europe at the British Museum. It's better than a box of black magic.
It is. I mean, to be fair to Henry, he kept the romance going. He didn't actually execute Catherine of Aragon. She was just under house arrest for the last couple of years of her life. I mean, it's lovely, isn't it?
What a guy.
Yeah, what a guy. Next on Times Radio, why your office coffee machine could well be an opening for sinister cyber criminals. But while you're there, I'll have a flat white. Thanks very much. Here are the headlines. Tom Noonan, just after 2:30.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sir Starmer is accusing his former communications director of lying about his links to a convicted paedophile when he was elevated to the House of Lords. Matthew Doyle supported Sean Morton to be a councillor after Morton had admitted possessing indecent images of children. The Prime Minister says Lord Doyle wasn't clear with him, but Kemi Badenoch says some of those links were already public knowledge when he was given a peerage. The Times' chief political commentator, Patrick Maguire, doesn't think the line from Downing Street is sustainable.
Kemi Badenoch is right. It was on the front page of Sunday Times. There were pictures of Matthew Doyle wearing a T-shirt that said re-elect Sean Morton, after he'd been charged with possessing child sex abuse imagery. And given they found that out on the 27th of December or whenever it was, and then Matthew Doyle made a peer at the start of this month, you sort of think, what has actually changed?
Volodymyr Zelensky's chief legal adviser has told The Times the Ukrainian president has tasked MPs with finding a way to hold elections while martial law is in effect. She says the deadline for that is the end of this month. A butcher who cut her girlfriend in half and buried her in a garden more than 15 years ago has been jailed for at least 21 years. Police found Isabella Sablocka's remains last June. She was 30 when she died in 2010. 40-year-old Anna Podawarna has been convicted of murder, preventing a lawful burial and perverting the course of justice. And police say two pupils seriously injured in a stabbing at a school in northwest London are not in a life-threatening condition. A 13-year-old has been arrested. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel. The magical destinations you love. The personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
Okay, that's six of the ragu and the linguine. Make a move, everyone, please.
The customers are rolling in at Stefano's new restaurant, so he needs another chef. Someone with a cool head and an appetite for success.
More flour in the bechamel, let's go.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Sponsor a job on Indeed to unlock more tools that save you time and help you hire quality candidates. To start hiring, visit Indeed.com/try today.
The to-do list. Expert recommendations for the best TV, film and music. Sunday nights from 11:30 with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar joins us.
We're just agonising over the sorts of conversations that people have at our age. Let's just face it. We're glad to be kept busy. That's the gist of it, isn't it, John?
It is exactly that.
Yes.
Glad to be in work.
Yes.
John, you are on air from 4 o'clock this afternoon.
Yes.
Where will you start today?
So, I mean, a lot of politics, which is not exactly new, but I think some interesting things, really interesting things to talk about. So, women in the Labour Party, this is interesting and really significant, or actually we will find out over time how significant it is or is not. But what is interesting right now, I think it's a product of Keir Starmer's great weakness that he needs friends wherever he can find them. And he's reaching out in all directions. And part of that, I think, is reaching out to women in the Labour Party and saying, look, the door's open. I want to hear what you have to say. You've got complaints, and there are many, many complaints, and they're going to be heeded. And so today he's been talking to the women in the Parliamentary Labour Party. We're now seeing some women closer to the very top who are and feeling they can get more of a hearing now. Their voice is going to be heard more clearly because the Prime Minister is rather more vulnerable than he used to be. And so that opens up what has been a running conversation for a very, very long time, which is a kind of extension of the dinner table topic, if you like. If women were in charge, wouldn't things be so much better? And as well as being a kind of, you know, a flippant point over the second course, it is actually a very, very important one. And here we can talk about it and maybe talk about testing the whole thesis. I don't mean just on the basis of equity, of, you know, better representation of our demography as a human species. I mean, just changing things, and changing things, you know, possibly for the better. And if so, how? How is that going to happen? So I'm going to be talking to Lisa Nandy in the Cabinet. I'm talking to Labour MPs, including Emily Darcy, and Senator Helena Kennedy, Lady Helena Kennedy, who was a leading KC in the House of Lords. I'm looking forward to that conversation. I'm also going to be talking to the Russian oligarch in exile, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, about Ukraine. I'm going to be talking to Fogh Rasmussen, the former Danish Prime Minister, about, you know, European defence, NATO, and, of course, Russia as well, and other things too.
Looking forward to that very much. John takes over from us at 4 o'clock, runs through on Times Radio until 7.
That's absolutely right. Now, offices with all mod cons, such as smart aircon and coffee machines, may make the working day more bearable. But have companies across the nation opened themselves up to hackers? Today's Times reports that cyber criminals are exploiting building systems connected to the internet in a hurry during the pandemic. Yes. Ruth Edwards is a former Tory MP and a cybersecurity expert. Oh, it's just good to just get ourselves involved in a whole new world of terror, Ruth. No, I mean, let's just find something else to panic about.
Be scared of your coffee machine.
It was a very scary report, I have to say, particularly around the fire drill.
Yeah, well, we'll take us through that in a moment. How vulnerable? First of all, define a smart office for us. Indeed, as you look around you here at the wonderful facilities we have here at Times Towers, is this one?
Well, gosh,
no,
not so much those headphones. I would very much expect so. Yes, a smart office is anything where you've got equipment that's, you know, connected online. So you use the example of coffee machines, but a lot of building infrastructure like I don't know, heating, air conditioning, all the dull stuff you don't think of, access, that's all connected as well. And that's why it's so potentially so serious if hackers have control of that.
OK, and smart offices, when did they start? When was the first so-called smart office?
Gosh, I couldn't give you a date when we had the first one, but they'll have been around for many years now. I mean, and that's part of the problem in a way, because some of the systems that you have in place controlling these buildings are sort of much older than when sort of cybersecurity started really coming into the fore of people's minds. So we've had a lot of focus on securing computer systems, mm-hmm. But some of the operational technology, or the OT as it's known, there's been a big focus on that, and there always has been in critical national infrastructure, but not so much perhaps in building safety. And that's what your report, I think, picked up so well, flagging the gaps there are there.
OK, and now how can these gaps be rectified? What can we do?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about the report was how some of the examples they cited were so incredibly basic. So they talked about having usernames and passwords were set at admin. Well, nobody running any kind of system should be doing that. That's hugely irresponsible. You know, you wouldn't even do that on your own personal computer.
No,
would you?
No.
So there's a lot of the basic security like that, and I think, you know, at the moment, the government is, they are assessing what should count as critical national infrastructure. The Cybersecurity and Resilience Bill is going through Parliament. It's in committee at the moment. And there's a big conversation about whether big supermarkets, for example, should be counted as critical national infrastructure for obvious reasons.
Well, I would say yes, surely.
Well, exactly. I mean, we saw what happened in the pandemic when people started panic buying. Obviously, that had nothing to do with a cyber attack, but think of the havoc you could wreak, right? Yeah. And it's the same with building security, particularly because buildings, particularly high-rise buildings, which are many of the lovely offices like the one you're in here now, mm-hmm. They are now required because of the Building Safety Act to have a digital, they call it like a golden thread. So all this data, information about the building, its construction, its operation, really critical, important information is now going to be stored online in one digital record. So potentially, you know, you've got a really sensitive, you have a very sensitive set of data there that
right.
needs protecting.
And if someone with evil intent can gain access to that, we're a busted flush.
It depends what they do with it, but they can certainly use it to extort money. They could use it to endanger people, depending on what they did. They could just use it to make your life very uncomfortable by turning the heating right up to the extent where you have to send people home, or the same with the air conditioning. But again, you know, that is a huge cost for firms in terms of downtime. We've seen that quite recently with Jaguar Land Rover. Obviously, it wasn't their office, but they brought their production line to a standstill.
Yes, I mean, that caused an enormous amount of, well, a catastrophic impact on industry in the West Midlands and and indeed elsewhere for quite a considerable amount of time. It was months, yeah. Wasn't it, before that was sorted out?
Yeah, it was several months. And, of course, it was the 1,200-odd businesses in their supply chain as well that were at huge risk.
So let's talk about this fire drill, because it is apocalyptic sounding. So these hackers have done something unpleasant. The fire alarm goes off. What happens then?
Well, nobody could get out the building. So the doors were obviously sealed by the hackers. So instead of everyone being able to get out, you know, the door and the fire exit as normal, people weren't able to leave. Now, fortunately, in this particular instance, there was not actually a fire. But can you imagine the sort of panic?
Well, you
have no idea, do you?
I should just be clear that this happened. It actually happened in California in the summer of 2024. I mean, it's a quite presumably a low cost act of what is, frankly, terrorism, surely. It's a horrible thing to do.
Well, whether or not it was done for political reasons, I don't know, but you would certainly terrorise the people in there. I think more likely it will be used to try and extort money from businesses. So in the same way you see ransom attacks, where people will either, they'll hack into the system and they'll either steal your data and blackmail you for money so that you don't release it, or they might lock you out of your system and say, "Oh, we're not letting you back in your system until you pay us." And in some cases, they'll do both. I think that's what happened to M&S.
Yeah.
And now here, they could blackmail you, say, "Well, you know, basically, we'll make your office illegal for people to work in there because we'll turn the heat up and we'll keep it on, and you have to replace your whole system if you're not going to pay us ransomware." So, you know, businesses have really got a responsibility to improve the security of the operational technology that's, you know, keeping the lights on and the temperature right and the doors open or closed.
Is it sensible to keep on building layer upon layer of tech to deal with tech, to deal with tech, to deal with tech? Isn't there also a logical argument that we just go back to an analog place? So if something like that did happen in an office building, in every office building, there would be an exit entrance that wasn't governed by a digital force. Why are we ignoring that?
I think that's a very fair challenge. And I was very surprised to read that there wasn't a manual override on the exits, for example. So I can see, you know, the attraction to controlling things digitally. You know, you can get things to a much more exact level. You can do it from wherever you are. But I completely agree that you need to have fail-safes on key infrastructure like that. We've seen an interesting debate around the handles on electric vehicles recently. So, you know, they don't jut out like a normal car handle. They're into the car, but they've now installed these manual overrides inside in case the car crashes, because some people haven't been able to get out of them in crashes in recent, you know, recent years. So that it's so important to have that. And I think just also, even if from a personal comfort point of view, even if you're not being hacked, if the computer goes wrong and you can't sort out, you know, your lights or your heating or your aircon. I mean, I remember I once stayed in a very nice hotel in Abu Dhabi and I'd arrived very late. It was on a parliamentary...
Were you a Tory MP at the time?
No, I wasn't. I was working for the Home Affairs Select Committee.
Okay.
So I was a House of Commons member of staff. It was a very nice hotel. And of course, everything was, you know, are done electronically. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I got undressed and I thought, going to bed, and I thought, where's the light switch? And I thought, well, I'll just get in bed and see what happens. Nothing happened. And I thought,
so
I'm obviously
dark.
I'm in the light.
You're in the light.
It's like midnight. I can't get my lights off. And I'm thinking, I'm clearly being really dim. I've spent too much time on the road. And so I had to phone reception, really embarrassed, and say, I'm really sorry, I don't know how to switch the lights off. He said, oh, they'll just switch off when you're in bed. And I said, well, I'm in bed. I've been in bed for 5 minutes and the lights are not off. The lights, they were broken. So they had to send somebody into my room at midnight to like get the ceiling panel up and his ladder out and sort it all out. And I just thought, oh my gosh, could you not have just had a light switch?
I mean, the 21st century can really disappoint, can't it? I went to the cinema yesterday and it was some digital, I didn't know it was digital, but I thought they were still using projectors. Anyway, they just couldn't get the thing to work.
Oh no.
So we all got our money back.
Oh gosh, disappointing.
It needed a reboot or something.
Oh,
so,
crikey.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not very sleek, is it, somehow? Anyway, that's just a minor anecdote. Do you miss the House of Commons?
I do on some days, definitely.
Like today?
I think today's a bit of a depressing day, really, for anybody involved in politics. I mean, I always say that the majority of people, regardless of what party they go into, want to get in there to make a difference. And something like this, just it snarls up the entire media agenda. It snarls up the, you know, most of government, and certainly all political airtime is spent on that. I mean, what's happened is very serious, but I think it's a depressing day really for anybody who's really, you know, passionate about politics.
Right, and just briefly back to the cybersecurity issue. Should we be worried about our domestic appliances too, if we have got an incredibly sleek coffee maker at home? I don't have one, but let's say I did.
I think you need to be sensible reading, you know, what the security on them is.
Well, could you not just go old school and have a traditional appliance?
Yes, well, I have a fairly traditional appliance. Hasn't let me down, so you could have either, really. But I think just, you know, when you're using digital technology, it's just important to keep in mind, you know, what are the sort of safety things, you know, how often is it supported with safety updates, and it's just a question of making yourself aware about those sort of conditions on the appliance, so you know.
Thank
That's
you.
My advice.
I just don't know. I know I don't know enough. That's all I know. Ruth, thank you very much. Former Tory MP.
Pleasure.
And an expert in cybersecurity. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Right, coming up, why you might be seeing more of your favourite Disney character on TV. That and more of this week's Bog Standard Television with critic to the stars, Scott Bryant. It is 12 minutes to 3. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
It turns out you can please all of the people, all of the time. Garden games for the kids, a separate cottage for the grandparents, a private chef for that special occasion. Simpson Travel, idyllic Mediterranean holidays that everyone will love. We take care of the details, so you can enjoy the moment. SimpsonTravel.com, because your time is precious.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So Sky has announced plans for its ultimate TV package, giving viewers access to Netflix, Disney+, Hayu and HBO Max under a single TV subscription. The companies describe the deal as world first and the best value on the market. But is it? Scott Bryant, TV critic, joins us now. It is a big deal because they're telling us it's a big deal, but is it a good big deal for us?
I mean, I think it shows we've gone full circle again, which I think is rather fascinating. I think basically it used to be, of course, that many of us were signed up to a sort of £30 a month contract, joining particularly because we wanted, you know, we were joining a streaming service because we wanted to get away from a big cable bundled option, only for us to now probably have that be the most affordable, lucrative way of actually making it work. It will be with all of these new tariffs, ones with an ad. So you would be, for example, if you've got Sky and you're getting Disney Plus, you will get advertising within there. This also comes off the back of HBO Max launching in the UK, which will be having a lot of exclusive HBO programs when previously they would be available only on Sky.
Okay.
So I think essentially, yes, you can possibly make a saving, but I also think by and large, the reason why people were using streaming services in the first place is to give them flexibility. And it seems to be a bit unclear if you join this new package, whether you are able to still have that.
Okay. I never really understand the adverts when I am watching something on a subscription service. I don't understand why I have to have them if I'm already paying for it.
I mean, I think a reason is particularly the cost that it is generally cheaper than actually going without them. I think viewers have actually now started to favour them. More people have a subscription tier with adverts now than actually have without. And I think a few years ago, 5 years ago, Netflix were against them. But now they realise that growth in terms of people only having a subscription to a service without adverts has slowed down dramatically. I think when the credit sort of, when the cost of living crisis started to set in, I think a lot of people started to go, oh, hang on, why am I spending $9.99, $12.99 when I can actually spend $5.99 and only have to endure a few minutes of adverts? I just find it so funny that we've gone full circle, yes. To be honest.
I always just feel taken advantage of when the adverts come up. And also they do tend to be heavily, heavily repeated as well, which drives me bonkers. Let's talk about betrayal. I've been looking forward to talking to you about this all week, Scott. The Times has headlined its review with Sean Evans' spy saga piles on the tension. This is on ITVX. It is a spy thriller. It's got an extraordinary opening scene. Would you like to describe it?
I mean, what an honour to say that to talk about this on Times Radio. It features our lead character, our main protagonist, going to a service station, going to a service station loo, and then applying hemorrhoid or cream, or at least getting it out of his bag to apply it. He then meets with a contact and it ends up being an intelligence thriller with a lot of blood. But I think it's the hemorrhoid part, and I highly thank the subs for the way that they were able to add on that reference there, yeah, in their headline.
I mean, it's made for some great jokes in headlines and reviews. I mean, all hail for, you know, being realistic in drama. It is good to see that. But what I couldn't quite understand was why that didn't ever really develop as part of the plot. Because I thought, well, there's got to be a reason for that being the opening scene. But it doesn't. His piles aren't really important. Are they, Scott?
His piles aren't important. Is that what you said?
I mean, how do I follow this up? I would say it is referenced later in the episode.
Yeah.
So if that's not a tempting a way to get you to watch the programme, not sure what else is. But I think the show tries to do an intelligence thriller whilst also being quite ITV home and domestic simultaneously. Whether it manages to do it successfully, I'm not always sure. It feels quite kind of ITV drama-ish, if that makes sense. They always feel like they have a type. But let's face it, this one's a little bit different.
It is a little bit different. And it's not my favourite. It's not my favourite, that's all I'll say. Should we talk about Lord of the Flies? It landed on iPlayer this weekend, written by Jack Thorne of Adolescence fame. What are your thoughts about this? Do you think it's a cracker?
I mean, I do think so. I mean, I think a lot of the reviews have been very positive towards it. I mean, this is, of course, an adaptation of the William Golding book. Tense thriller, as you would expect it to be. I think one of the things that strikes you from watching is it's a primarily unknown cast. It was done primarily through open casting as well. A lot of the boys who are in it are only between the ages of 10 to 13. The plot, you know, follows them on an island. All of the adults who are with them are killed or presumed dead. And essentially we see the order descend into anarchy. I think what it does so well is it's directed in a really unconventional, really quite tense way by Mark Munden, who I think lingers on the shots that you would expect for it to cut away just that little bit longer. And I think it really adds to the level of suspense. It's not the most comfortable 9 p.m. Sunday night show, but it shouldn't be. I mean, it's Lord of the Flies. And I think it's also rather interesting with Jack Thorne, who is also, of course, the co-writer for Adolescents. I mean, they feel like companion pieces in a way, because they do talk about, I mean, it talks about power, it talks about masculinity, it talks about male rage, it talks about, I think, class in a certain way. I mean, it's an amazing, I think, look at the human condition and also how easily it can be corrupted.
Yeah. Another absolute belter that is coming out is Lisa McGee's new show, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. It's out tomorrow. It's the first thing that Lisa has done since Derry Girls. I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Jane Garvey, for this element of questioning, Scott, because she's been privy to it. I haven't.
Yes, I've only watched the first couple of episodes, though, Scott. How do you sum this up? Because Derry Girls was a comedy. This has certainly got comedic elements, but it's also a thriller, and it's got a supernatural bits and bobs as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is different to Derry Girls before, but I think that's a good thing. I think it's great when shows try to, or writers try to evolve. And also, Lisa McGee has written thrillers before. She wrote a series called The Deceived. It's on Channel 5. It was good. It was also co-written by Thomas Beer, her husband. Tobias Beer. And with this one, it's about a set of friends who go back to Northern Ireland because a friend of theirs has died. But I think what's rather interesting about it is that whilst with Derry Girls, I mean, you felt like you knew the characters immediately from the off. With this new series, they've all got secrets that you're trying to work out what they are. Mm. But it manages to maintain and be very reflective of Lisa McGee's humour. You can tell immediately that this is a Lisa McGee written show from the off. Very, very sharp one-liners. I think it also still taps into community growing up. It's about older friends reflecting on their younger selves. I think any more can't really reveal because there is an embargo for it being released tomorrow. But I would say that I think, well, Netflix are very pleased that they've got this and that they have invested in it and they think it's going to be a big hit overseas.
Yeah, I mean, there are 8 episodes. I have to say the scenery alone is one of the reasons for watching it. But also just a cast of extremely well-known Irish folk. I mean, Ard O'Hanlon's in there, Emmett Scanlon, and Sinead. I always want to call her, I've got a friend called Sinead and I want to use her the wrong surname. Her name is Heenan. That's right. Okay. And she's in Unforgotten, but here she's using her comedy talents.
Yeah. And I think also the one thing that stands out is the chemistry between the three friends at the heart of this piece. It feels very similar to Derry Girls. It's something that you expect and you get sparks flying pretty much immediately from the off. It's one of the show's main draws.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. It's also just worth saying that the excellent actor from Waiting for the Out is in this too. That's Josh Finnan, I think that's right.
Isn't yes, it? Yeah. Yes, great show.
Yeah. Brilliant.
He's had a
brilliant
very, very busy year.
He has.
And he's done well. Scott, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. We were
discussing Betrayal, which is on ITVX. Lord of the Flies is on iPlayer. And that new show, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, is out tomorrow. It's available on the Netflix.
Right, it's that difficult time of the afternoon as we head to 3 o'clock. It's not quite time for a biscuit yet. You'll have to wait about 20 minutes and we'll allow you to have one as we wait for Zach Goldsmith, who's our big guest after 3:30 this afternoon, talking sculpture and much else besides. Let's enjoy the music.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Jane's got a little bit local radio there. Radio London Bridge calling. It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Still to come, children are being bombarded with adverts for weight loss jabs and pills. We're going to hear from the youth charity Ditch the Label. Spurs have sacked their manager. We'll find out why with our favourite sportsman, Vassos Alexander. And as Jane said, our big guest today is former Conservative Minister Zach Goldsmith on why he swapped frontline politics for life as an animal sculptor. Let's get the news first with Tom Noonan.
Fee, good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has accused his former Director of Communications of lying to him about his links to a paedophile when he was made a peer. Matthew Doyle supported Sean Morton even after Morton was charged with possessing indecent images of children. The Prime Minister says Lord Doyle wasn't clear with him about that and says he has suspended the whip. But the Labour peer and Times Radio presenter Aisha Hazarika says he'll have to go further than that.
They are going to have to not just remove the whip from Matthew Doyle. I think they are going to have to say we are going to try and remove this peerage, because you can't have somebody who this terrible association, and they're going to be a legislator for life. They won't have the Labour whip, but they're going to be a legislator for life and get funded by the taxpayer for life. That's not going to cut it with the public.
Kemi Badenoch accused the Prime Minister of putting paedophile apologists in positions of power after appointing Lord Mandelson ambassador to Washington. Survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse have accused the Trump administration of using its entire weight against them. They've accused officials of nothing short of failure in how they've handled survivors. They've spoken outside Congress before Donald Trump's Attorney General faces questions in Congress. Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal referenced developments in the UK when calling for accountability.
And around the world, princes, ambassadors, even prime ministers are being brought down for their participation in this global sex trafficking ring. And here in America, that needs to happen too.
Volodymyr Zelensky's chief legal adviser has told The Times the president has instructed MPs to find a way to hold elections despite martial law. Ukraine's constitution prevents any elections while martial law is imposed. However, after pressure from the US, the president's office says Ukraine will look at changing the laws to make it possible. A Polish butcher who cut her girlfriend in half and buried her in a garden has been sentenced to at least 21 years in prison. The family of 30-year-old Izabela Zabloka lost contact with her in August 2010. 40-year-old Anna Podewarna was found guilty of killing her at their home in Derby. Detective Constable Emma Birch thanked Isabella's daughter for her support during the investigation.
Her determination saw missing persons charities contacted in Poland and interest from reporters. The tracking down of Anna Podewarna began the journey to uncovering the truth behind Isabella's disappearance.
The King and Queen and the Prince and Princess of Wales have expressed their shock at a mass shooting at a secondary school in Canada. At least 9 people have been killed, while the suspected attacker has also been found dead. Police have described the shooter as female. The High Court is hearing a legal challenge which could overturn government legal guidance designed to prevent migrants using modern slavery laws to delay their deportations. 16 migrants are challenging their removal under the one-in, one-out returns deal with France. The government says this is exactly the sort of case it's trying to prevent. And Tottenham Hotspur are looking for their third men's manager in the space of a year after sacking Thomas Frank. The former Brentford boss has only been in charge for 8 months but leaves the club only 5 points off relegation, having won just 2 of their last 17 games. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So Keith says, regarding the connected devices, I've just got a RoboVac. It's very efficient. It's got lasers. It's made a map of my flat and it knows where I sleep. Should I be worried? Yes, Keith. I mean, we can call you every day to make sure you're all right. But yeah, it sounds like the RoboVac's got some moves on you.
Yeah, I mean, imagine that. You come to in the middle of the night and there, gawping at you, is the RoboVac. And you don't know what its intentions are.
I find it all just so discombobulating, Jane, because, you know, you spend so much time trying to get the tech installed and then I get a total red mist descends if I then can't work it, and then I've forgotten my password, and then I just have to smash something up, and then I just have to buy a very old-fashioned alarm clock.
I'm worried about Keith on, what about on Valentine's night? Maybe you wake up in the night and the RoboVac's there with a red rose between its teeth.
Hmm?
Oh, that'd be terrifying.
Yep, or maybe it's just having some quiet time with the dustpan and brush.
Special time.
Right.
Right, move on.
It's 3:04. A new report by the Children's Commissioner for England found products which claim to change their bodies and appearance are regularly being promoted to very young people. Dame Rachel D'Souza told Kate McCann on Times Radio Breakfast how companies were getting around the regulations.
It's not just a simple advert. It's often an influencer. So someone a young person looks up to, and then they just pop in these adverts, you know, these hashtags at the end, so that it gets round a lot of their illegal and harmful kind of advert
issue. Oh, you mean when the influencer just puts hashtag ad or hashtag sponsored or, okay.
Recommends it. So lots of kids are picking up there, but there is also literally advertising, and because Ofcom's reach is limited, and because local authorities not, you know, who are meant to have oversight of some of this stuff are not, you know, don't have the capacity, it just goes unchecked and it's not good enough and it needs sorting out.
Well, all of this has led to calls for further restrictions, more accountability and age-appropriate redesigns. Let's talk to Dominic Arnell, who's the chief executive of the youth charity Ditch the Label. Dominic, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Can we just, in detail, learn a bit more about what products and what drugs we're talking about here?
Absolutely. So there's quite a broad range of drugs that are included in the report, but I'll take a few that I think are significant. So firstly, weight loss injections such as Ozempic, Mounjaro have been marketed to young people. And secondly, skin whitening cream has been marketed as well. So I know in the pre-brief we talk about drugs that can change someone's appearance, but they really are incredibly significant and can be very harmful.
Tell us a bit more about what you can see, because an awful lot of people, if you're not in the algorithm, then you're not getting sent this stuff, and some of it is quite mind-boggling.
Well, there have been studies showing that if you join these platforms as a young woman, you get marketed these products incredibly quickly. So they will market you with pro-skinny algorithms that will start to push these sorts of products. And it can happen in a huge variety of ways. So sometimes it can be straightforward advertising. And as you mentioned in the preamble, a lot of the time they'll use influencers to market the products in the belief that this will get around Ofcom's rules and regulations. There's a bit of a disagreement on whether or not this does get around rules and regulations. It is advertising. You are advertising to children. And Ofcom do have powers to regulate that.
The algorithm is just such a huge part of the problem, Dominic, isn't it? Because parents aren't seeing the same adverts. Gone are the days where you'd be sitting down watching TV. You might be lucky to be watching TV together, and therefore you'll be able to say, oh, don't go anywhere near that, or, you know, I've tried that, it's not very good, or are you interested in that? You know, I get targeted with adverts because I'm a 57-year-old woman for endless products that will get rid of my belly fat. I know that my 18-year-old daughter is not being targeted with those, but I don't know what it is that she's seeing. They wouldn't send it to me.
It's a very good point, and not only are you seeing different adverts, but there's a pattern to the adverts you're seeing. So the adverts that a young person can see online can slowly progress. So they don't start off by marketing them with weight loss drugs. They could talk about being skinny in other ways and actually build up to pushing weight loss drugs at a point where a young person is really feeling quite fragile about themselves and their self-image. I mean, it's a very complex algorithm and it's designed to shift products. And for that reason, they're very heavily incentivized to make sure that you're in the perfect position to buy, which unfortunately for something like weight loss drugs is likely that you're in a position where you feel bad about your appearance and you want to do something about it.
So tell us about the legals surrounding this at the moment. And is it the same as with other forms of advertising, whereby until somebody complains, there actually isn't that much that can be done about an ad?
Well, that's how the regulator works. So you can put forward a complaint and you can complain about an ad. Of course, that's very difficult to do if, as you say, you aren't seeing the ads that your young people are seeing. So parents couldn't complain in the same way. That said, there's a reason why they aren't advertising with Govee during Saturday morning cartoons, for example. And if they did, Ofcom would intervene very quickly. So it's our view, really, that Ofcom does already have powers. And I know that the Children's Commissioner has called for an expansion of existing laws. We absolutely support that. But there are already legal vehicles we can use to make sure that social media sites are being much more careful about the adverts they show young people.
Surely there is some protection then offered because you do need to prove your age to actually buy the product, don't you?
You do. I mean, I think if you were to compare it with something like smoking, and I think that's a fair comparison, we don't just ask people their age and then give them the product. Actually, they're in a process where they have to show ID. If someone looks underage, the person behind the till may well say, actually, I don't believe that you're the age you are. So it's a lot more difficult in order to get that product into your hand. Unfortunately, the protections we have online simply aren't working. I mean, as the report shows, 1 in 10 young people has purchased or tried to purchase one of these products as a result. So my view is if young people are getting hold of the product, we need to look very seriously at the protections that are in place. And moreover, we need to look at the incentives behind the people that are building the protections and say, well, are they really incentivized to stop this from happening? Or are these protections there as a way to meet their legal responsibility?
When it comes to influencers, what can we do about them? I mean, they are people who, let's assume, they don't set out to do harm to anybody. They're making their own way in the world. They're recommending a product. They're not in control of who they're recommending it to. Could we really realistically do anything about that now?
I think focusing on the influencers themselves is probably a bit of a red herring, because the influencers are very often individuals that exist within an incredibly complex system that is managed by some of the richest organisations in the world. So our suggestion is that we look at this from a platform level, that big social media businesses have a responsibility to protect their younger users and make sure that whoever's pushing this out and whoever's selling it, it's not reaching younger users, which at the moment it is. I think for influencers themselves, I think that of course we would recommend that they didn't, particularly influencers with a high proportion of young followers, push these kinds of products. They are incredibly harmful. And if you've had the misfortune to meet as many parents as I have that have lost young people to disordered eating, I think you'd be a lot more careful.
Yeah. I mean, we just need those stories to be heard, don't we, Dominic? And I know that that's exactly what you're doing, and you're very welcome, you know, to use the next couple of minutes. You know, we've got a platform. Tell us more about what families have gone through because of all of this.
Absolutely. So there have been a host of families that have lost young people as a result of their engagements online. And that's for a huge variety of reasons. So some of those young people have become almost unrecognisable within a very, very short period as a result of being pushed beauty products, for example. There's also, we've had reports that if you delete several selfies in a row, you can be pushed makeup. So in other words, the algorithm is sort of recognising where your insecurities might lie and making sure that it's pushing you products and selling to you as a result. Now, sometimes this can make it sound like there's a man in a box somewhere looking at you, and it doesn't really work like that. The algorithm's recognizing patterns in behavior, and once it finds a user that wants to buy something, it goes out and looks for another user that has a similar behavior style. The trouble with that is, of course, because there's not a man in a box controlling it, what that means is it can recognize a profile of a young person and then go out and look for other people that meet this profile. So it's incredibly dangerous. I think across social media, the thing that we're seeing time and time again is that they just haven't really been designed with young people in mind. Now, if you're going to market a system to young people, as social media has been for many years now, it's really important that you build in safety at the design point. That hasn't happened, sadly. We believe that, you know, there's no reason for young people to be scared of being online. It can be a fantastic place for young people to learn, to connect safely on sites like the Digital Label Forum. Getting my sort of post in there, but it's overseen by clinical professionals, which makes it a very safe place for young people to engage. And I think outside of that, it's really important that parents just understand what your young people are doing online. And I do appreciate, as a parent myself, that is easier said than done. But when you have met as many parents as I have, for whom this has got away from them, and suddenly they're faced with an environment where they didn't know what was going on, and they've got a young person that, God forbid, has met a stranger online, got themselves into difficulty, is being blackmailed for photos. All of these things have happened online, and I'm afraid all of them have led to the loss of young people.
Yeah, which is just so, so tragic. Any parent can try the I pay for your phone, therefore I'm going to look at your phone line, because we are paying for their phones usually, aren't we?
I don't think a phone should be in a bedroom. I really don't. If you've got young people that are under the age of 18, should they have a phone? There's all manner of products now that you can use to make those phones a bit safer. I would say that in my experience, young people tend to know the way around them slightly better than the parents do. But giving a young person a phone and sending them to their bedroom, in my view, is really asking for trouble. There's a whole host of things on the internet that we wouldn't let a child have in their bedroom. And if you can imagine that this bedroom is now a source of all of these things all at once, bad actors, extreme pornography that depicts women in ways that could be harmful to the development of both girls and boys. It's important we get hold of this.
Sure. Do you think that if there were a ban on social media for under 16s, lots of people say it simply wouldn't work, what's happening in Australia, you know, the jury is out. But do you think that it would change exactly what you're talking about from the companies who code, the companies who make these algorithms, because they would simply know that it will be harder and less profitable for them to be sending messages, building that kind of algorithm for the under 16s. Am I being fanciful in imagining that that might be a decent outcome?
Not at all. I mean, we don't support the ban for the reason that one of the results that's happened in Australia, slightly predictably, is that young people are now lying about their age to get onto the platforms. The trouble with that is, in a way, it's a worst case scenario. Now we've got young people on the internet and we don't know who they are. So we support young people being given access to child-friendly versions of existing sites. All of this is perfectly possible. And I must stress, you're talking about some of the smartest, wealthiest people in the world. If they want this to work, it can work. And our view is create versions of the sites. Some of them are starting to do this now, though unfortunately they're not as effective as they could be yet, that are safe for young people and let young people have those spaces. I mean, we're a small NGO and we've managed to do it. It's perfectly possible.
Mm. I think that's such a key phrase, isn't it? If they want it to work, it can work. And I know that Dame Rachel D'Souza has spoken about her frustration when she's in the room with some of these people right at the top of the tech world, that they just don't seem to understand the imperative to make that change and why it's a good thing to make that change.
Yeah. I mean, I share her frustration, absolutely. I think, look, there are great people in tech that are recognising that this is a problem and are coming around to it. It's a sort of a sad consequence that they're realising it right at the point where we're discussing a ban altogether. And my message to social media companies would be, give us an alternative. Tell us how you can make your platform safe for young people. And if you don't, I'm afraid we'll be left with no option but than to pursue a ban.
Yeah. I mean, I think the terrible truth as well is, Dominic, that for quite a lot of these men, and it is men who are in charge of these huge platforms, they only seem to come to a realisation about kids' safety when they have kids of their own. And their kids, actually, but you know, because most of them are in their kind of 40s now, they haven't yet got to that age where they're desperately unsafe on those platforms.
Yeah. I don't believe that they don't know. There's no way that they don't understand.
Oh, no, I'm sure they know, but I wonder whether their family has been affected in the same way as, you know, the families that you've met.
Well, there's a lot of reports and a lot of them have spoken about it publicly that they won't be giving their children iPhones, for example.
And that says it all.
Allowing their children on the internet. The people that are designing these platforms aren't allowing their children to do what your children are doing, essentially.
Yep. Really good to talk to you, Dominic. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. That's Dominic Arnell, who is the chief executive of the youth charity Ditch the Label.
Yeah, I was interested in Dominic's reference to that notion that when a young person has deleted two selfies, that's when they get bombarded with beauty products.
Yeah.
That is referenced in that really interesting book, Careless People, by Sarah Wynne Williams. So it's all about working for Meta. If you want to know more about that, she certainly says that happened and that was a tool that they developed.
And if you're using the filters that will make you look paler, because there's a lot of sales of skin lightening creams going down, or you're using a filter to make yourself look slimmer, that feeds into that algorithm that then sends you the product that might harm you in your pursuit of that.
Oh, it's really depressing. Let's cheer ourselves up by thinking about Spurs, who have sacked.
Good link.
Yes, thank you. I really am on top form. They've sacked their most recent manager, Thomas Frank. It's unfortunate for him because he was quoted last night as saying he was confident he'd stay in post. Well, he did until this morning when he was fired. Anyway, that's the subject for Vassos Alexander's sports slot, which is imminent here on Times Radio. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes. The kitchen and bathroom sales now on. Explore all the sale offers at wickes.co.uk or pay a visit to your local Wickes store.
Romantic retreats, luxury beachfront hotels, expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel. The magical destinations you love. The personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
Spire Healthcare gave me my life back.
The care I received was incredible.
Every year, over a million patients trust Spire Healthcare. See a leading medical expert privately in as little as 48 hours and get back to what you love sooner.
Spire Healthcare had given me a whole new lease of life.
And now I feel unbreakable again.
The sooner you're better, the better. Search Spire Healthcare today.
The Story.
the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
It's 8 minutes until 3:30. Work out the time for yourself. 3:22. Our big guest is Zach Goldsmith, who's going to talk. Well, he's going to talk about his sculpture. He's coming up at 3:30, but he'll also talk about politics and the environment, I imagine, Fee.
Yes, I think the battle between nature, progress, and politics is one that he's particularly interested in.
Mm. B has WhatsApp to say, let's listen to Jane and Flea flirting with their sports commentator like they now do every day.
I don't think there's much flirting going on in here, but
I can assure you, B, that there's absolutely none. But here is hunky Vassos Alexander with today's sports item.
Ooh, Vassos. Right, there we
there
go.
There we go, we've done it. Fans of Spurs chanted, you're getting sacked in the morning at the team's manager last night. I think it was probably also the chant of the opposing fans, wasn't it?
Well, no, the point is, at Spurs, it's the Spurs fans who have for several weeks now
been chanting
okay, you're being sacked in the morning, and hoping that he is.
And he was. They did lose 2-1 at home to Newcastle United, and they've had a run of miserable league form. They're now 16th in the Premier League and only 5 points above the relegation zone. So this was expected, wasn't it, Vassos?
It really was, yes. I mean, where did it all go wrong for Thomas Frank? It was a bit of a gamble for both parties, for Tottenham bringing in the Brentford manager who'd had seven very calm, very successful years at a much smaller club,
yeah,
Brentford.
With lower expectations.
Yes, exactly, and much less spotlight, and adored by the fans. I mean, I don't know Thomas Frank, but I know a lot of the people around him when he was at Brentford. I've run with some of them, and he's just a thoroughly decent human being. So here he goes, and he's got clear ideas, or he did when he was at Brentford, how to play football, how to manage people, and he took those to Spurs, and it just seemed to unravel quite early on.
Yeah.
And some pretty tame defeats, and Tottenham fans will be, you know, they always say, we don't really care as long as we play good, engaging, attacking football. You know, I sort of half believe that. Mm. But, you know, against Arsenal, against their big rivals, it was very timid. There was no sort of identity. And he did look, in recent weeks, he looked very beleaguered, and he did look a little bit clueless. So, like you say, not a huge surprise after losing to Newcastle last
night. The club do get a bit of a break now because they haven't got another league game.
Yes, till,
and then on the 22nd, they play...
They play Arsenal again.
So that actually could be really exciting. But by then, presumably, there'll be a new person in post. Who will it be?
Well, we don't know. John Heitinga, who was brought in as a first team coach 2 or 3 weeks ago in mid-January, former Ajax manager, former Fulham player, he has been taking training this morning. And he will, you know, there are some in the Spurs hierarchy who will think, yes, he could be the guy. Or, you know, there's very... some of the Spurs fans want Maurizio Pochettino back, who took them to a Champions League final.
He has got a job, hasn't he?
As manager of the USA, who are hosting the World Cup this year. So, you know, would he go back to Spurs? To be fair to Thomas Frank, it is extraordinarily long, the injury list that Spurs have. But then that was the case last season under Ange Postecoglou. So is there some problem at Spurs with, you know, with all these injuries? Are they training in a slightly different way? You know, who knows? I always find it slightly, you know, like, so the fans last night are singing, you're getting sacked in the morning, his own fans. And I remember, like, a couple of weeks ago, Martin Samuel wrote a piece in The Times, and he said, it's one of the trials of this job, he said, sacking people, not actually doing it, but saying it. Football managers get binned all the time, but I still think of them as the little people, even the really famous ones. They are employees, after all. They've got kids at school, probably hearing rubbish about their dad in the playground, and often it's not even their fault. So, yeah, I mean, yes, it's expected. Yes, he is the 6th manager, permanent manager, to be sacked so far this Premier League season. The record, incidentally, is 14 in one season. So, yeah, you walk into a job and you know there's a high chance you're going to get sacked. And if you do, you're going to get a relatively decent payoff.
Well, you'll get a huge payoff.
Mm. His contract was to 2028. But as I understand it, these days, clubs don't pay out the whole of the contract. There'll be some kind of clause that says you'll get 6 months or something like that.
Okay, right. Aren't they still doing all right in Europe, though?
Well, absolutely. Like they were last season when Ange Postecoglou brought them a first trophy in 17 years. And this was the whole thing. This was the sort of the hammer that Arsenal and other fans would hit Tottenham fans with, is that you haven't won anything in so long. And Ange Postecoglou, he said at the start of the season, I will win something this season. And he did. The Europa League, which qualified for the Champions League, where they are now. And they sit fourth after the group stages. Right. So they're straight through to the round of 16 and doing, you know, very nicely indeed with some great results. But it's the league form and it's the lack of identity, the sort of lack of a sense of an identity that I think has done for Thomas Frank. And this new board, Daniel Levy, who sort of ruled Spurs with an iron fist for so long, he left in September, October time. And this new board are desperate to be liked, I think, by the Spurs fans. And you know, you hear the whole stadium singing, "You're getting sacked" in the morning, week in, week out. Eventually, you know,
it's going to happen.
The axe is going to fall.
There is that term, Spursy, isn't
yes,
there?
Yes, and there's Dr. Tottenham.
Right. So, what does Dr. Tottenham mean?
Are you having a bad time? Are you low on confidence? No win in 10 games? You need a visit from Dr. Tottenham.
And then you'll get a result.
And then you get the result. Like West Ham, who were really struggling, went to Spurs, 1-2-1, and they haven't looked back since.
Right.
And the Spursy term is, I think even Tottenham fans call themselves Spursy. They'll, you know, win the Champions League, but get relegated.
Well, I was going to suggest,
beat Manchester City, but then lose to West Ham.
Wouldn't that be the most Spursy thing ever? They win the Champions League this season and get relegated.
Absolutely. That would be peak Spursy.
Okay, brilliant. And so to the Slopes, where Team GB have failed to shine. Let's just be honest about it.
Yeah, but there's another way of looking at it, isn't there?
Is there?
Yes, that we aren't a nation blessed with the right kind of climate for our wonderful athletes to be training in. We've done very well to get to fourth. A lot.
we have finished fourth a lot. We do. I mean, we do invest in these Winter Olympic sports. You know, there are millions and millions of pounds
goes into.
Don't worry, the skeleton hasn't started yet. We're bound to win the skeleton.
Oh, are we though?
Well, in the men's skeleton, we were first and second. In fact, the two British skeleton riders won all seven World Cup events. And we have a rich history in women's skeleton. So we are definite favourites to win skeleton gold.
OK. What did you think of the Norwegian guy with his desperate plea to his girlfriend?
So this is a guy who wins a bronze medal and then in the press conference afterwards says, "This has been a really difficult few weeks for me because I was unfaithful to my girlfriend, the love of my life. And so much as you might think that this Olympic medal is everything, I actually had won at life with this wonderful woman who won't now take my calls because I had an affair." And in doing so, took away quite a lot of spotlight from his Norwegian teammate who'd won gold.
Right.
Their great friend.
Well, they were.
Their mutual great friend had died a couple of weeks before the game. Oh, so the Norwegian biathlon team are sort of in mourning. And the guy who won gold screamed his late friend's name as he crossed the finishing line and in tears on the top of the podium. So he did draw a little bit of focus away from that. He has today said, "I apologise, I'm not in a good place." And his girlfriend has come out and said it's very complicated.
Yeah. It is very complicated. It was just so strange to see that happen on a very, very public stage. I mean, you just feel for everybody involved in that, don't you?
You really do. And you can sort of get it, can't you? He's, you know, he wants to mea culpa in order to try and win her back.
Actually,
and he thinks in his muddled brain, maybe, this is how I'm going to do
it. I blame the world of tech, where everybody is telling everybody everything in social media posts. So there isn't that sense of, kind of control that you should have in those scenarios.
Privacy,
Oh, my God, privacy.
Yeah. What? God, I know, that'll never catch on. They're very young as well, these Olympians, aren't they? I realise I could be the grandmother of almost every competitor. It's so depressing. B has come back and said perhaps Nigel Havers is more Jane and Fee's cup of tea.
Or Jeremy Irons.
I once stood behind Nigel Havers in a queue for a drink at a bar. And do you know what he ordered? And he ordered it in a Nigel Havers voice.
I'm going to say a Campari.
Gin and tonic.
He said, "Could I have a Purdy's?"
A Purdy's?
Remember that?
What, the vitamin drink?
Yeah.
Once fashioned.
Like a posh Red Bull. Red Bull with A-levels. Yeah. Yeah, that's what he went for, yeah. Vassos, there was absolutely no flirting there, but I'm now going to be on my guard. I'm slightly nervy.
I'm not talking to him.
Vassos will be back with some more sports balls for you tomorrow at around the same time. Thank you, Vassos.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, from Conservative Minister to Animal Sculptor, it's not a sentence I've ever read out before. We're going to hear about Zach Goldsmith's career change. It's just gone 3:30. We'll get a check first on the latest news headlines with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Sir Keir Starmer is accusing his former communications director of lying about his links to a convicted paedophile when he was elevated to the House of Lords. Matthew Doyle supported Sean Morton to be a councillor after he was charged with possessing indecent images of children. The Prime Minister insists Lord Doyle wasn't transparent with him, but Kemi Badenoch says the links were public knowledge because they were already published in the Sunday Times. Luke Sullivan, who was Sir Keir Starmer's political director before the election, says the scandal is likely to intensify.
What the Prime Minister did get through today was, you know, he was forced to put on the record an allegation against Lord Doyle in terms of the answers he gave and the accounts he gave through the process. But this is going to roll on, I'm sure, for days to come.
Volodymyr Zelensky's chief legal adviser told The Times the Ukrainian president has tasked MPs with finding a way to hold elections even while martial law is in effect. She says the deadline for their report is the end of this month. A butcher who cut her girlfriend in half and buried her in a garden more than 15 years ago has been jailed for at least 21 years. Police found Isabella Zablocka's remains last June. She was 30 when she died. And a four-day cold weather warning has been issued for central and northern England. The alert from the UK Health Security Agency runs from Friday morning until Monday. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your new service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Life is short. The world is big. See more of it with Wild Frontiers. Experience the soul of Georgia through traditional winemaking. Find your Zen on ancient pilgrimage routes in Japan. Or enjoy a 1,000-star experience in a yurt camp on the Silk Road. Wild Frontiers' expertly crafted journeys take you further, so you can wander often, wonder always, and worry never. For small group tours and tailor-made adventures, visit wildfrontierstravel.com.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast, 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
What have Boris Johnson, Trudy Styler and Lady Caroline Bamford got in common? There's no prize, I'm afraid. It may have already been won, though, if there was one, by Zach Goldsmith, whose sculptures they have bought. He turned his hand to sculpture during the pandemic whilst in lockdown. He started with wax models, worked his way up to bronze, and he's selling them with the proceeds going to charity. Toothpicks and knit combs were involved in his process. Zach, very good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
We so need to know more about knit combs and toothpicks. So how are they involved in your sculpting process?
The list goes on. Anything you can... If you're making something out of wax and you don't... You know, I'm not a professional. I've never had a lesson. You use anything. Use a pencil, a toothpick, a cheese grater, anything. Anything becomes a potential tool if you're trying to create an effect on the wax or the thing. So I have a pile of very eccentric tools, and they do the job, I think, more or less.
Right. Well, it's good to know that you're a man of the people and your kids have knits. I mean, that's one thing that we can take from that.
They never don't have knits, as far as I can tell.
It goes on and on and on, doesn't it? Talk us through what happened then that led to you turning to sculpture, because I don't think it would have been in the Zach Goldsmith game plan, would it?
No. I actually started with wood. We had a really beautiful ancient oak tree which came down in one of the storms. This was before COVID, but a really beautiful, you can imagine how wide, probably 300, 350 years old. And I didn't want to chop it up for firewood. I wanted to use it. So I ended up carving a big chunk into a kind of double size silverback gorilla. So that was, and I wasn't planning on doing that. I just knew I wanted something to be carved. I've Googled, I found a couple of professionals. They were going to do the job for me, but they wouldn't work with oak because it's too hard. They wanted to work with pine or something softer. So I did it myself, and I enjoyed it, and it sort of more or less did it. It worked. And so I just got the bug. But you can't, the thing about wooden sculptures, it's messy. You can't do it indoors. It's all you're doing. If you're doing wooden sculptures, nothing else comes into it. It's 100% commitment. Whereas whether you're with wax or clay, you could be chatting, you could be on the phone, you could even be on a Zoom call, as long as you're not expected to do too much performance on it. You can do it in your office, you can do it anywhere. And so I just got involved in wax, and I loved doing it. It became almost an obsession. Almost.
And how many sculptures have you made, if that's the right verb?
I mean, probably about 30, 40. I'll go for months without doing one. I mean, at the moment, I have a huge blob of wax that has been on a desk in my office now for about 2 months, and I just haven't had time to get to it. But I will do eventually turn it into what I'm planning on turning it into.
Okay. But when you look at the blob, what are you seeing in
your annoys me that it's still just a blob, but I want to turn it into something else. But it will be... It will be two lion heads. That's the idea.
Okay. I mean, we've got to address the literal elephant in the room, which is that you can sell these sculptures for vast amounts of money. Is that because you are Zach Goldsmith?
Well, I'm sure it helps that not everyone who's bought them has been a friend or known to me. You mentioned some people before. You know, these are people I've worked with before. I wasn't planning. It was never part. I never imagined that I'd be able to sell them. I didn't make them thinking I'm going to sell these things and become a sculptor. But I'm always asked to provide things for charity auctions. And I've sort of stripped my house bare of anything interesting that would go well in an auction. And you kind of run out of ideas of experiences to add to the menu. So I sort of tentatively, slightly nervously added one of these sculptures. It was a big, giant Galapagos tortoise into one of the auctions, and people went crazy for it. There was a huge bidding war. It sold for vastly more than I could ever have imagined it was worth. So I thought, okay, this is easy. I'm doing something fun. I love doing it. It's not that difficult, and I'm making a lot of dosh at the same time for charities that I would otherwise be struggling to raise money for. So it's going to win-win, very lucky.
Really. Sure, sure. Are those charities all nature and environmentally based?
Pretty much all animal welfare or nature. Pretty much. But I mean, that's because those are the people those are the causes that I've always been involved in. I wouldn't not contribute pieces to other causes, but my first one, I think, was for that amazing organization Animals Asia, which campaigns against bear bile farming. I don't know if any of you or your listeners have ever Googled them or seen the images. I can't think of anything crueler that humans do. I mean, keeping these bears for up to 30 years in such confined cages, they can't even scratch themselves, and they have a rusty thing shoved into them, and their gallbladders are milked for some mad medicinal purpose. And this one organization, set up by one incredible woman called Jill Robinson, is actually on the cusp of ending this practice. She's campaigned in Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam. She's just done the most incredible thing, a completely kind of just ordinary person who decided to make this her mission and has done it. She's a champion. So that was one of the things that I was very happy to contribute to. And when these things sell for pretty significant sums of dosh, that it makes a difference. It will, it will push her campaign on a little bit further, and it's a great thing.
Are we allowed to know what type of animal Boris Johnson bought?
Do you know what? It was a gorilla.
Was it?
Yes, it was a gorilla. A small one. Wasn't one of the giant life-size pieces. I've got a lot of gorillas, lots of different ones. And my first was a little jackdaw, which I actually rescued from someone's chimney, a little baby. And I brought it up, and it became a great friend. And I remember my office when I was a minister at the time. And it was all during COVID, and obviously everything was done virtually. I'd be on the computer doing my very serious Zooms, and the bird would just fly onto my... I'd accidentally leave my window open, and the bird would fly in and sit on my shoulder, and I'd have to pretend it wasn't happening in the middle of these conversations. And it became very famous in the Foreign Office in DEFRA, virtually. And then eventually she came less and less, and she joined a wild flock. I would see her sometimes, but probably once a week. And so I did a little portrait of her. That was my first kind of real one, first wax one. But now I do a lot of animals that I've met. You know, I had I did a portrait of a gorilla, which I met in the Congo. And I mean, I guarantee none of your listeners will believe this, but I met that gorilla nearly 20 years before in Kent at Howlett's as a tiny baby gorilla running around the lawn. And if someone had said at the time, that little gorilla, you're going to meet it in the wild, a fully grown silverback, and, you know, having been rewilded by the Aspinall Foundation, I just would never have believed them.
Right, so that was why the baby gorilla was in Kent.
That was why it was in Kent. All those gorillas that can be rewilded are being rewilded. I think they've put 100 gorillas back into the wild. Almost all of them have survived, if not all of them, breeding. 120 babies have been born on the back of it. It's just one of those wonderful organisations that actually does stuff.
Right. Well, the breeding and Boris Johnson have something in common. We might go back to it. You are known for your environmental credentials. You co-headed the review of the Conservative Party environmental policies under David Cameron, which was quite a moment, actually, in politics. Can you take us back to that time and tell us what it was that he then took on board? Because I think that is unrecognisable, actually, to where the current Conservative Party is with its environmental policies.
The party has been... So I was not even involved with the Conservative Party at the time. And I think I'd met you 5 years before that when I was doing The Ecologist magazine. And I think... I forget where we were talking. But I was plucked from that by David Cameron and his team and asked if I would help them come up with a sort of blue-green manifesto. What would a conservative approach to the environment look like? Worked on it for a year with a bunch of very good people. We produced a document which was far, far too big, in my view, but we did. And some of those things were taken on, others weren't. But the point, I think, is that the Conservative Party at that point had lost sight of the environment. And there's no ideological reason why a Conservative Party or a Conservative movement should not care very much about the environment and conservation. There's nothing unconservative about that, on the contrary. Looking out for future generations, living within your means, ecological means, all these things are, you know, inherently conservative, but they lost it. And I think the Conservative Party did then what we're now seeing the right do here today and in the US and elsewhere, and that is to look at the environment, see only one part of it, which is carbon or net zero. So whenever we talk about the environment, all people think about is carbon. And because that's a kind of left-wing cause, according to the right and the conservatives, they just chuck the whole thing in the bin, leave it to the left. And I think it's a tragedy. So, you know, the greatest environmental movers and shakers politically in the US have always been Republican, going all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt. He created all the great national parks. And here, you know, even Margaret Thatcher, you know, we forget, she was the first leader to really acknowledge climate change. She was the reason that the Montreal Protocol is probably the only really successful international agreement so far that I can think of. It just got lost, I think, in the kind of politics of net zero, which has become very toxic and I think very reductionist. You know, you would have climate COPs right up until the one we hosted in Glasgow, where no one would talk about forests, no one would talk about nature, no one would talk about the ocean. But if you don't, and you could put a solar panel on every single square inch of roofing across the world, you could cover every field with windmills, it wouldn't make the slightest bit of difference if we lose the Congo Basin or if we lose the Amazon or we lose the great forests of Southeast Asia. And yet those things don't feature. Why is a mystery to me, but that's, I think, one of the problems with the left's approach to the environment. And I think the response of the right to that is just to walk away from the whole thing. And it leaves the environment in a pretty lonely place.
But isn't one of the things that we cannot balance nature and progress? So now we are very much told that if we support nature, we aren't supporting progress. And sometimes there are valid reasons for that, Zach, because, you know, if you're a very hard-working commuter and actually your congested roads do need something to change and you can't get a bypass because the bats need a tunnel, or, you know, you can't get a decent house built because the newts need better protection, that seems to be the battle that has been drawn by politicians in front of us.
But I think that's almost always just an excuse. And I mean, if I can look a little bit more internationally, just because that's my job it was in government, and it remains. You know, I walked through in the Republic of Congo, as opposed to the Democratic Republic of Congo, I walked through the Republic of Congo, through their oldest logging concession, and I was taken there, and I fully expected to be very depressed by this. I walked through an area where I could see almost no sign of human activity. You had the biggest population of forest gorillas, the biggest population of forest elephants of anywhere in the Congo Basin, and yet this was a place that had been logged twice. And they've broken the link through a very strict code. They employ vastly more people in the logging sector, proportionately, than any of the neighbouring countries. But their forests are growing, not shrinking, because they've got a strict code. So they've broken that link between deforestation and logging. Indonesia, for years, was wiping out their forests to make way for palm oil and things like that, pulp and paper. Today, there is almost no deforestation from palm oil or pulp and paper, yet both those sectors are growing. They've figured out how to do it. Costa Rica was one of the poorest countries in the kind of all of Latin America. It's now one of the wealthiest, probably the most politically stable, and it's the only country in all of the Americas that has increased rather than decreased its forests. They've broken the link between progress and just despoiling their environment. So I just think in each of those cases, it's the people, not just one or two corporates or a couple of corrupt politicians. It's the people who've benefited from sound, solid policies. Good stewardship of the environment normally makes for good government. There's a very clear correlation between the two. So I don't buy into that. I think there are lots of things we do which have an impact, and there are lots of ways in which we can balance that by doing other things. But the idea that it's progress or the environment, I think, has been completely debunked.
Where do you think the Conservative Party stands at the moment with its environmental credentials?
I mean, right now they need to figure that question out. I've spoken many times to Kemi. We take a different view, for example, in relation to climate change, but I don't think we necessarily take a different view in relation to the natural environment. That hasn't come through in policy yet, but it absolutely has to. I don't think any political party deserves to be taken seriously if it doesn't have a response to the ecological crisis that we're facing. And it is a crisis. There's no argument. You can argue forever about climate change, but there is no argument that biodiversity is collapsing around the world. There's no argument that these vital ecosystems that make life possible are shrinking. 1 million hectares a year of the Congo disappearing. This is not opinion, it's fact. And I think any political party needs to have an answer to that. It can be a left-wing answer, it can be a right-wing answer, it can be a central answer, but they need an answer. And this, I hope, is in the pipeline. I think it is in the pipeline. I think Labour have really done a very poor job in relation to the natural environment. I think they're very bullish on climate and the energy transition, but when it comes to nature, they've effectively walked away. I remember resigning as a minister under Rishi Sunak because I felt that we were treading water, that we weren't going forward. It was incredibly frustrating. But we're actually going backwards now, quite rapidly, from where we were under Rishi Sunak. And I think that's partly because the Conservatives haven't been putting pressure. I felt pressure when I was in government from Labour. It was a very healthy, good pressure. I enjoyed it. And from the green environmental NGOs. I don't think the Labour Party feels any of that pressure. And as a result, they're just going backwards on pretty much every international and domestic nature issue.
Do you think the Green Party is still green under Zach Polanski?
I don't. I think it's become a kind of, a slightly more brash and attractive version of the Corbyn Party.
Isn't it going to be hugely important that at least there will be a party attracting attention at the next election that is prepared to talk about nature, to talk about the environment, to be that place?
But I'm not sure. I totally agree with you. I mean, I've voted Green in the past. I've even given money to the Green Party in the past. But I don't think the Green Party today is really a Green Party. When you look at the big speeches, the big moments of the Green Party at the moment, the environment is very rarely mentioned. It's mostly identity politics and tax the rich, all the sort of obvious stuff that you would get from the Corbyn Party, but packaged in a more attractive way by Zach Polanski and his team. He's a good communicator, there's no doubt. But I don't think it's a Green Party. I don't think, for example, and I know I'm going to divide, possibly even lose all your listeners here, but if you look at the time where Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, I would be willing to debate anyone, any time, that on his watch, the UK government was greener, better for the natural environment here and overseas than at any other time in our history. I don't think anyone's come close. And I think after he was booted out, after it was clear that he was gone and he wasn't coming back, then you had a kind of reluctant admission. You had the Guardian, the Independent, the FT, papers which are really not his mates, sort of reluctantly acknowledging that. I even had Green Party, senior Green Party people, who I weren't embarrassed by naming, texting saying, what on earth are we going to do now for the environment? Same people who'd been sort of shrieking about Boris being thrown out just a few days before. So I would love all of the mainstream parties and the up-and-coming parties to have a sort of coherent approach to dealing with the natural environment. I think you can separate net zero. I don't think you can achieve net zero without nature in any case, but even if you push that to one side and just focus on repairing those or protecting those ecological systems without which we have no future at all on Earth, I would love the mainstream parties to be competing in that space.
Yeah.
And I think people do care. I know it's sort of, it may not be, if you ask 100 people, what's your top three priorities? Nature's not going to come up for many people in the top three. If you are in an area with crap schools, you're going to say education. If you can't afford a house, you're going to say, you know, shelter. If you're sick, you're going to say the NHS. Everyone's going to have an immediate priority that absolutely trumps nature. But if you ask people whether or not they want more nature in their life, they want more leadership from government on nature, it doesn't matter who you ask, black, white, rich, poor, left, right, old, young, everyone wants more nature and more leadership on nature.
You're absolutely right. And it's the place where people find joy. It's a place absolutely. Where people find peace. And it would be dreadful if it died on our watch, wouldn't it? If you were invited back into politics, would you go?
Well, I kind of am in politics. I mean, everything's politics. Like, and if you sign a petition, you're in politics.
I mean, would you, you know, if there was a Tory government again, would you want to be seat at the table type of politician?
I don't know to what extent. I will always, you know, I've been working quite a lot with elements of the current Labour government on these issues. And, you know, when David Lammy was in the Foreign Office, I worked very closely with him because he is a nature champion. He was, I think, the only senior Labour champion. I was very sad to see him moved out of that department because I don't see any of that leadership now that he's moved. I'll work with anyone. I mean, anyone. This is so, in 100 years' time, if we turn things around, people aren't going to be worrying about which party delivered solutions. I just want to know that we were serious about it.
A couple of other things we would really like to talk to you about in the moments we've got left. Of your Jewish heritage, you say that you've developed a stronger sense of identity after recent world events. We absolutely know what world events you're talking about. What has that meant to you?
I mean, I was always brought up to feel sort of pride in my that part of me that is Jewish, but I never was observant. I would go to synagogues only for, you know, cousins and so on, for their bar mitzvahs and various ceremonies, but I never went as a family. We never, you know, worshipped and partook in that way. And it was kind of a very ancillary part of my identity. And what happened on October the 7th, not the atrocity itself, although that was just grotesque beyond measure, it was the reaction to it, which I felt that it sort of triggered something in me. And I know this is true of almost anyone I know who has, you know, significant Jewish blood. And it was the fact that within 24 hours, long before Israel had gathered itself together to work out what its response was going to be to the biggest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, long before that had happened, you had people taking to the streets and protesting against Israel. And it wasn't just the usual suspects. You had people, I saw people on on Instagram and Twitter, people I know personally, who I respect and have always liked, using slogans which are genocidal, and they know that. You can be clever about the language. You can pretend that jihad, global jihad, means this rather than that. You can pretend river to the sea means something very technical. But we all know what people really mean when they use these slogans. And even if, on an intellectual level, they can defend the use of those terms, they know what everyone else is thinking. If I hear, you know, globalize the intifada, I hear Bondi Beach in Australia, I hear massacres, you know, or attempted massacres around the world. I look at the security outside the Jewish school near me in Notting Hill, which is surrounded by security guards. That's what I think of when I think of globalize the intifada. And I know that that is what people are thinking when they use these terms. And I found it extraordinary that you know, we lost Anne Frank's posthumous stepsister just a few weeks ago. She was a friend of mine. I did events with her at schools for quite a long time where she would speak about her experiences. She's only just died. That's how recent the Holocaust is. And yet you've got people now seeing it as almost a badge of honor to identify themselves with something which is just so unimaginably grotesque in such a thoughtless manner, just because that is where they think the zeitgeist is. And it tells you how easy it is to manipulate people into doing terrible things and aligning with terrible ideologies. And I find it frightening. Most Jewish people I know, when they have put their accounts on Deliveroo or eBay or Amazon or whatever, they don't use their Jewish name. They'll call themselves John, you know, Smith or something. I know many members of my family do as well, because they worry. They worry now that someone's going to turn up and recognize when they knock on the door that it's a Jewish person, and they'll get thumped or worse. And that's a very ugly situation to be in. So I'm much more aware of that part of my identity now than I ever have been. And I know that that members of my family who've never really even been remotely interested even in the politics of Israel are now paying attention in a way that they probably wish they didn't have to.
Zach, thank you very much indeed for coming in this afternoon. You can view Zach's collection, Art for Nature, at NoHo showrooms from today until the 28th of February. And a very quick Google search or other search engines are available online will take you to images of his sculptures.
It's Times Radio. It's 4 minutes to four now. Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
How I Made It on Times Radio with Sky Business Mobile. Join Ed Vasey and Associate Business Editor of the Sunday Times, Hannah Privett, every Friday morning as they capture the human stories behind the entrepreneurs who have built their businesses from startup to startling success. How I Made It, every Friday morning with Ed Vasey on Times Radio with Sky Business Mobile. Only Sky Business Mobile rolls over unused data and automatically shares it with your team. See skybusiness.com for T's and C's and verification.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Life is short. The world is big. See more of it with Wild Frontiers. Experience the soul of Georgia through traditional winemaking. Find your zen on ancient pilgrimage routes in Japan. Or enjoy a 1,000-star experience in a yurt camp on the Silk Road. Wild Frontiers expertly crafted journeys take you further, so you can wander often, wonder always, and worry never. For small group tours and tailor-made adventures, visit wildfrontierstravel.com.
Okay, James, I need you to do a few more drops than yesterday, I'm afraid.
Carl needs to find another driver for his expanding courier business. Someone who'll really help to lighten the load.
Any issues, give me a call.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do.
South today, what about you?
Indeed helps you quickly attract, screen, and virtually interview great candidates, all through an easy-to-use dashboard. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Thank you for your messages. Alistair says, that was a very interesting interview. At last, a break from the psychodrama. Simon says, what an interesting person Zach Goldsmith was. I always thought of him as an upper-class twit.
But all of you have very much enjoyed that.
You've all liked him. Yeah. You've all liked him.
So good for us for booking him.
Yeah, Ruth says, great interview with Zach Goldsmith. I don't share his politics, but I did enjoy that interview. And from Bestie, please tell Zach there are many of us for whom the environment, nature and climate change are of the greatest concern. I do wish that politicians, whichever party they represent, would see the big picture on these issues. If we carry on as we are doing, I seriously worry for the future of the planet and, as a consequence, humanity. It was a brilliant interview. Thank you very much. Well, that was Zach Goldsmith. And another listener has said, we've been a bit sniffy about having him on. Not at all. Perhaps a little earlier in the week, we were laughing perhaps at the notion of a man who could play around with sculpture in a way that perhaps we couldn't.
We can't. So if you and I tried to sit down and make a jackdaw out of wax, I mean, it would look like one of those candles that's been on the table too long in an Italian restaurant.
Yeah, I mean,
it wouldn't work, Jane. We won't be able to sell them for £500,000.
No, for charity. No, I don't think we could. But let's all get busy with any stray wax we found, not including earwax, around the house tonight to see if we can mould something that is recognisable. That's your homework for tonight. Now, tomorrow's guest is the novelist Jenny Godfrey. She had huge success with her debut novel, and she has another one out, I think, tomorrow. It's called The Barbecue at Number 9, and it's set on Live Aid Day. So Jenny is our guest then. Who do we want to thank?
We would like to thank Hannah Quinn and Ryan Boyden. John Pienaar is entering the studio. I say that more in hope and anticipation.
We are not doing overtime.
Than fact.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks, Fee. I'm John Pienaar at 4 o'clock with Drive on Times Radio. And here are the headlines. On a busy programme today, I can assure you. So Keir Starmer says his former communications chief lied to him over his past relationship with a convicted paedophile. And President Zelensky has asked MPs to work up plans to hold an election while martial law is in effect. And coming up, Keir Starmer, is he ushering more women into his decision-making? You can hear my interview with the Labour MP and with Baroness Helena Kennedy. And our weekly check-in with the Times Sports Desk and from the Winter Olympics.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you. Sir Keir Starmer has accused his former communications chief of lying to him over links to a convicted paedophile. He made Lord Doyle appear 2 months ago, despite him supporting Sean Morton, a councillor who was found guilty of indecent images of children.
Mr Speaker, Matthew Doyle did not give a full account of his actions. And on Monday, I promised my party and my country there would be change. And yesterday, I removed the whip from Matthew Doyle.
Matthew Doyle has apologised, and Downing Street says the Prime Minister did not know about his connection to Morton. However, Kemi Badenoch says it shows a pattern of behaviour after the appointment of Peter Mandelson as US ambassador.
Nobody buys it, Mr Speaker. Not even the Labour women, because they know he always puts the Downing Street Boys Club first. And how dare he criticise us? We weren't the ones stuffing government with hypocrites and paedophile apologists.
Volodymyr Zelensky's chief legal adviser has told The Times the president is asking MPs to work up plans for elections. Ukraine's constitution currently bans them while martial law is in place. However, after pressure from the White House, the president's office says he is looking at ways to hold a vote. Deputy chief editor at the Kyiv Independent, Alexei Sorokin, says it could just be a delaying tactic.
Donald Trump has asked a lot of things from Ukraine over the past year. We know how the Ukrainian officials are dealing with this. They say, okay, sure, and then they phase it out and see if Donald Trump forgets about it. And I think that's the strategy for the past year. I don't think anything changed.
The president's office says MPs will report back by the end of this month. Iran's foreign ministry has said Israel is deliberately betraying what he called their peaceful nuclear program as a nuclear crisis. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington, D.C. and hoping to meet Donald Trump. A Polish butcher who cut her girlfriend in half and buried her in a garden has been sentenced to at least 21 years in prison. 30-year-old Izabela Zabloka lost contact with her family in August 2010. 40-year-old Anna Podawarna was found guilty of killing her at their home in Derby. The High Court is hearing a legal challenge which could overturn government legal guidance designed to prevent migrants using modern slavery laws to delay deportations. 16 migrants are challenging their removal under the one-in-one-out returns deal with France. The government says this is exactly the sort of case it's trying to prevent. The King and Queen and the Prince and Princess of Wales have expressed their shock and sadness after a mass shooting at a school in Western Canada. At least 9 people have been killed, while the suspected attacker has also been found dead. The Prime Minister, Mark Carney, spoke to reporters with tears in his eyes.
Parents, grandparents, sisters, brothers in Tumbler Ridge will wake up without someone they love. The nation mourns with you. Canada stands by you.
Police haven't confirmed who the suspected shooter was, but have described them as female. And 12 men have been charged with manslaughter over the death of a football fan in Essex 5 years after he was assaulted. Simon Dobbin was left permanently brain damaged following the attack on his way home from a match in Southend in 2015. The former RAF serviceman died in 2020. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, it may be that only a weak man in Downing Street could have made a change so potentially significant. Like so much, it wasn't Keir Starmer's plan before he started fighting for his political life. But like much else, it seems to be the case now. Keir Starmer's right and left-hand men, his joint chiefs of staff, are now both women. The head of the civil service is about to leave his job, and the favourite to take over is also a woman. The so-called Boys Club, the inner circle around Starmer in Downing Street. Well, that seems to be on the way out, seems to be on the way to being abolished. The Prime Minister has been meeting his women Labour MPs, promising to listen to women and women's concerns in a way they believe hasn't happened till now. So on today's show, let's talk about what difference a shift in the power balance of the sexes may make. I've been around long enough to remember covering Margaret Thatcher in her pomp. I can also remember her strength as Tory PM being credited to her being the best man in the cabinet. So what does being a woman bring to the top table that a man maybe doesn't or can't? I'm really interested to hear the answer to that question. We'll be talking about it. I'm going to be talking live to the Cabinet Minister, Lisa Nandy. I'll be talking to Labour women in the Commons and in the Lords, and I'm really keen to hear your take. So do send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. I haven't even got to the backstage struggle to take over Keir Starmer's job. He's got himself a little more breathing space, it seems. It still seems to many to be a question of when, not whether, Starmer will be driven out of number 10. We will see. But has his leading pursuer, Wes Streeting, blown it? We'll talk about that on the show. First thing, Cammy Badenoch. She attacked the Prime Minister earlier today in the Commons for what she described, and she's not the only one, as the so-called boys' club in the top team at number 10.
Nobody buys it, Mr. Speaker. Not even the Labour women, because they know he always puts the Downing Street Boys Club first.
Mr. Speaker, my legacy is changing my party and winning a general election. And I'll tell you this, I kicked my former leader out of my party. Her former leader, Liz Truss, broke the economy and has descended into bonkers conspiracy theories. I kicked her out of Parliament. She's too weak to kick her out of their party.
That's Keir Starmer facing Cammy Badenoch in the House of Commons a little bit earlier on. So Anna Mihailova joins us now, our political editor at Times Radio. Hi to you, Anna.
Hi, John.
Hiya. I'm going to come to the seemingly endless Netflix series of Keir Starmer's fight for survival in a moment, Anna. But you've been there at a Starmer's meeting with Labour women MPs. How did that go?
Well, so he came in, the Prime Minister addressed them for nearly an hour, and I spoke to one of the MPs, Natalie Fleet, who was in the room, who began her question to the Prime Minister saying that this is the worst week she has ever had in Westminster. Here's what she said.
It's the most ridiculous place in the world, and it's a place that you can come to make change, and there are horrendous things that happens to girls, and nobody cares, and nobody listens, and it doesn't matter how powerful you are, nobody takes you seriously, nobody listens, and nobody takes any action. Here's the best bet that we've got. He cares, and he is going to deliver, and it's my job to hold him to account around that. So this feels like a real opportunity that comes out of the worst possible situation. And let's never forget that the only reason that we are here is because Epstein's victims spoke out. That is the power of when women tell their truth. And we're at a pivotal moment in society. Since I came into Parliament, all I've ever wanted to do is shape a national conversation around rape.
So that was Natalie Fleet talking to you earlier on, talking about Keir Starmer as they were meeting the Prime Minister in that meeting room at Westminster. Anna, I mean, she sounded almost desperate.